You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Welcome to the Future of Automation in the Middle Class. This is the fourth of a series of events hosted by the Future of Middle Class Initiative here at Brookings that explores various aspects of how the automation is expected to affect the labor market for middle class and working class people. Today's discussion, it will focus on two distinct topics that I believe are under discussed to this point. The first will be focus on the design of social insurance in an automated world. The second will focus on how do we ensure equity of opportunity in a world in which automation potentially presents a threat to middle-class jobs. And before we get started, I want to extend a thanks to Ember Smith, Hannah Van Dree, Sarah Zhao for their assistance, as well as Richard Reeves, the director of the Future of Middle Class Initiative, for help pulling this thing together. And also, I want to extend a thanks to all our panelists for agreeing to participate in what I hope to be an intellectually stimulating conversation. Thank you. Richard, you can take it away.
Great. Thank you, Marcus. Let me add my thanks to you, Marcus, for leading this work at Brookings for the last 2 years. Within Brookings, our sort of shorthand for the project is Marcus and the Machines, which is actually the name I wanted to give the project, but it didn't sort of pass muster with, you know, development people and so on. So it's automation and the middle class. But that's how we think of it. And Marcus, you've just kind of provided huge leadership on this and some of the very in-depth work as well as impactful work. So my thanks to you. So my role is to moderate these two panels today, which I'm hugely excited about. So what I'm going to do is briefly introduce our first panel. And then we'll kind of kick into the discussion. We're going to get some short interventions from each of the panelists, then into a moderated conversation among us. Please join in. If you're watching online, you can email in your questions to events@brookings.edu. You can use hashtag if you're on social media, which is #automationpolicy. So please fire them in, and then one of our team will be sharing them with me so that I can put them into our conversation. So let's get into dig into panel one, which is, as Marcus has mentioned, about this idea of social insurance and what that will mean going forward. And what I want the panel to do is to think in decades rather than years here. I want us to be thinking longer term. Obviously, we're going to disagree perhaps about what it might mean. In fact, what I'm going to do, I'm going to try and set the mood for some blue sky thinking. How about that? That's how I want us to think, is like, where are we going to end up, to try and think long term and radically? Obviously, we have the big elephant in the room tends to be something like a basic income, if you're pessimistic about the outcomes for the labor market. But there are many other questions that are going to be raised around our safety net programs, from food stamps through tax credits. How do we manage the balance between incentives to work and the changes that might be happening on the supply side as a result of some of the shocks from automation and so on? So I'll stop there because people really kind of want to hear from our kind of glittering first panel and equally glittering second panel. So I'm just going to offer the briefest of introductions. Obviously, please do have a look at the bios of our panel. But we're going to be hearing from Marcus again. But before we hear from Marcus, we're going to hear from Deanna Farrell, who is the founding president and CEO of the JP Morgan Chase Institute, which has become a really kind of impactful thought leader in this space over the last few years since she's been leading it. We're going to hear from Michael Strain, who is the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. We're still used to saying our neighbor on Massachusetts Avenue, so virtually our neighbor. So you're going to hear from Michael, and you're going to hear from Byron August, who is the CEO and co-founder of Opportunity at Work, that investigates ways to rewire the economy in favor of those who may lack credentials, but certainly don't lack skills. And again, has been a real leader in this field. So I'm going to get brief comments from each and then kick off. And this question of how do we insure people against risk in this future where there may be more information. Deanna, let's start with you, if you don't mind. And thank you to all of you for joining us. Deanna.
Sure. Thank you for having us, Richard. And you're right, it's not so new anymore. We're in entering our sixth year of the JP Morgan Chase Institute. So I am delighted to share some thoughts here. I think the first question that I would answer as it relates to the topic here is, well, what are we insuring people against? What is the reasonable thing? And I think that automation is making worse what is already true today, is that people do not have a sufficient buffer to withstand the day-to-day volatility that is the reality of most Americans' life, even before COVID, but certainly now post-COVID and with the acceleration of automation that COVID brings. But I would say maybe as importantly as that is insurance against having the basics of life. Because for many Americans, and keep in mind, 90% of Americans consider themselves middle class, the basics of education, healthcare, housing are increasingly beyond reach. And so to answer the question, how do we think about long-term social insurance in this way? I think we really do need to think radically about not subsidies for housing or childcare or healthcare, which, you know, are, you know, chemotherapy for cancer, as opposed to what are the fundamental changes to society that are going to change so that we eradicate cancer, meaning where we have structures that allow affordable housing, that really build in childcare as a matter of course, that make healthcare a basic right, not a, you know, narrowly subsidized, you know, quagmire to access. And you would go beyond that to say, you know, education and advanced education to participate in the economy today, and in large part communications too, which have become a core infrastructure for us. I think as one thinks about this, there's this discussion about, well, how much of this is private insurance, how much is public insurance, and so much of the work of the Institute, for those who follow, are just how dramatically different the financial outcomes are for families that have a private buffer, people who are in a position to have some level of savings. And that's actually very important. And I can't stress how, whether it is in loss of income or exposure to any sort of the vicissitudes of life, a cash buffer, whether you're a household or a small business, it represents the difference between night and day for many, many of them. Having said that, we know, take, for example, unemployment insurance, for a few hundred dollars to make available the few hundred dollars of unemployment insurance that allow people to sustain consumption when they lose a job, a private household would have to have saved the equivalent of $30,000. So, you know, obviously it's a much more effective tool to use public insurance for many of these things. But I don't want to underscore that we also need job pathways that allow people to accumulate a cash buffer and wealth accumulation over time. Needless to say, this is all the more important if you bring a race lens to this, because the starting point for Black and Latino families on all these dimensions are way worse. Their savings in particular, their wealth is much lower. And so the public insurance mechanisms have to kick in even more aggressively for those groups of people. So that would be how I'd frame it to start, Richard, but I hope you come back to some of those points.
Well, I'm sure we will. The balance between kind of private and social insurance, I think, is important. How far it's about insuring people against future risk as opposed to current need. Michael, I'm going to come to you next. I think you're obviously a supporter of many aspects of social insurance, but you may have a slightly different view about the current gap between what's being provided to people and what they need, but also your views about how you think the labor market's going to go in terms of whether we'll need more or less social insurance as we go forward, and if so, will it be of a different kind? So, Michael, over to you.
Thank you, Richard, and thanks for having me on this distinguished panel. My first comment will be very brief, which is that we need to make sure that we are using the human capital that we have in the workforce, and that the labor market functions in a way that allows for people to reach their full potential. I won't say more on that because Byron, who will be speaking next, I think, is really doing some just pioneering work on that. I think there's an interesting distinction here between social insurance and insurance. And let me begin on the question of social insurance. I think when thinking about how social insurance needs to change, you first have to think about how automation might change the labor market. And there, I think automation is changing the labor market in some ways less than we had thought. There's been a big discussion about whether or not we need to radically reform programs like unemployment insurance because automation might turn us all into gig workers, that traditional employment relationships are increasingly going to be a thing of the past, and that our existing work-based social insurance system, you know, largely assumes traditional employment relationships. The evidence that we've seen over the past few years really casts doubt on that. Traditional employment relationships remain the dominant way that people experience the workforce. And despite changes in the daily lives of many people who live in large cities, things like Uber, for example, the broader trend in the workforce doesn't really seem to be toward more independent contracting and freelancing and less unless traditional employment relationships, or at least not nearly as rapid of a shift in that direction as many people had speculated. Will that continue going forward? I think it likely will. It's obviously very difficult to predict the future, but the kind of traditional employment relationship, I suspect, Richard, to answer your charge of thinking in terms of the next couple of decades, will, I think, continue to be the dominant way that people earn a living over the next few decades, which means that that the way that we currently do a lot of social insurance, unemployment insurance, again, for example, may not be adequate today, but there may not be as much reason to think it will be increasingly inadequate as we go forward. Another interesting aspect of this, of course, is that we have been living with the effects of automation for decades. And whether or not you think that social insurance programs need to be updated in the face of automation, really can be answered by asking whether or not you think that over the past two decades, social insurance programs have been adequate in the face of automation. I think it's important, again, we tend to conceptualize this as some sort of like a distinct event. You know, one day the robots will all swoop down and take all of our jobs. In reality, the robots have been taking our jobs for 30 years. And that's had a profound effect, particularly on the middle of the distribution of occupations by wage and by skill. The best insurance, as distinct from social insurance, against this is education and training. I think if you look at the effects of automation over the last 20 or 30 years, I think the United States has not given workers the support that they need and has not managed those effects adequately. The fault, I think, does not primarily lie in our social insurance schemes, but instead the fault lies in our ability to recognize talent and to give workers the skills they need, particularly in the middle of their careers, in order to manage the effects of a dynamic economy, and in order to maintain the ability to be productive in the face of economic change. When I think about the next several decades, Richard, as you asked us to do, that I think remains the key. The key is to ensure against those risks by figuring out how to do skills and training better. I think that kind of insurance, rather than tweaks to the unemployment insurance system, is really our best shot at managing the effects of automation and at making sure that our workforce is able to command high wages and is able to take advantage of economic opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Michael. And actually a perfect setup to Byron as well, I think, in terms of the emphasis on human capital. I'll just give a plug to some work that Bradley Hardy's done for us on the role of human capital as an insurance against downward mobility. We tend to think of our next panel, we'll talk a little about upward mobility and so on. But thinking about it in that sense of just preventing the need to upskill in order to stand still almost is something that I think is important, but also the extent to which our current system is working or not. And that's obviously, Byron, that's very much your field. So over to you.
Thank you, Richard. And I took the charge to think, you know, a couple of decades ahead. And so given that, I want to lay out some principles maybe that how, and Michael, your challenge of like, how do we need to update it? Because I tend to agree with Michael that we're not actually running out of work, and we're not going to run out of work anytime soon. You know, work is solving problems. And last I checked, we got plenty of problems. And there's, you know, it's healing, and it's, you know, it's caring for people, it's educating them, it's entertaining them, it's building things, it's fixing things. There's actually a tremendous amount of work to do. And even all the work that we think of as, you know, automation, I mean, I don't know how you guys think automation happens, but a bunch of people do work to automate things, right? Like at all levels. So there's just an enormous amount of work to do. So I'm not really buying the premise that people aren't going to have work, but I still think that there are ways that we need to evolve. What I think, broadly speaking, is a social insurance system, maybe things we don't think about as social insurance. So I just want to touch on a principles level on some how, some what, and some why. So on how, I guess my main statement would be, if the future is automated, then social insurance should be automated in the future. What's to say? It should be automatic. You should know when you can expect it, right? There should be triggering events. I think one of the tremendous weaknesses of our social insurance system now is how discretionary and arbitrary and unclear it feels to a person, right? And that applies to a lot of aspects of the system today. And we can talk about that. But that's, I think, one of the most important downsides, because there's a lot of uncertainty in the world, and working people are typically managing many different constraints. There's a lot of complexity to their optimization function, and social insurance that adds complexity rather than reduces it is not well designed. So that's the you'll hear that in the examples I give, but I think it should be like that. You should be able to expect it. Second, on the what, I think we need to take seriously lifelong learning and meaningful work as something that a system writ large needs to actually kind of guarantee. And so what would that look like? You know, on lifelong learning, and back to the point about being automatic, a huge barrier to people reskilling mid-career is, well, money. And it's not just the money for the training. That's the actually kind of the lesser of the problems. The biggest problem is the opportunity cost. How do I feed my kids? How do I pay my rent? How do I do all these things? So there, the sense in which you want a system that's relatively automatic, much more so than it is today, is number one, you want sort of a triggering event. Like, let's say you lose your job. Let's say your job is like, it doesn't have to be trade. It doesn't have to be a particular thing. You should have, I think Gene Sperling calls something like this, basic income to rise. Right. So it's the moment when you're going to have to change gears, and you're going to have to do the work to get to the next level in terms of skills and training, that you have the income support to do it. So it's a bit like TAA, but TAA is completely discretionary. It's very bureaucratic. It's too slow. And you have to prove a specific reason for why you lost your job. Who cares what reason? Like, you should be able to move quickly. A second aspect to that lifelong learning is actually to be able to build on the skills you have. And this is work we've been doing at Opportunity at Work, and to have because people gain skills on the job, right? Not just in school. And if those aren't recognized, it puts tens of millions of people at a real disadvantage. So if you want to get an outcome of meaningful work, right, then you actually need to help, institutions need to help people bridge. They need to do the work to gain the skills, but our institutions need to be better at connecting them to jobs and actually sort of signaling the skills they need to get. So that's the what, lifelong learning and meaningful work. And then a little bit on the why, and there's kind of more ideas in that, a little bit on the why. So humans are learners and problem solvers, and it's like a very fundamental part of our makeup. And in a funny way, the way we economists think about the labor market, supply and demand, is a little bit arbitrary, right? We think of labor supply as people who have a leisure preference, we call it, but if you give them enough money to do something, well, they'll get off their butts and do it. And we think of demand as, you know, we need to make something, you know, a company, and so we want labor supply. But that's kind of arbitrary, because if you look at the hedonics literature, like actually having meaningful work is a massively important part of people's happiness, of people's welfare, of people's well-being, right, of their utility. So it would be just as natural to create a labor market where the demand side was people's demand for meaningful work, and the supply side was different problems that needed to be solved, right? And to sort of do it. And that's the sense in which I think if you actually, if you think about the kind of tools we have, the very kind of automation tools, the agents and so forth, if we actually had an entitlement for people to, for example, their own software agent who could help tutor them, who could help them fill in the gaps of what they're missing, that they own, that helps them on their way, negotiates on their behalf, I actually think there's no reason you couldn't do that. Big institutions will have it. Rich people will have it. Companies, governments. What about sort of individuals navigate through that? And on the other hand, if you had the big things that need doing, some of which have a natural business model to pay people a lot of money, some of which have a less natural business model, like elements of the care economy, for example, or elements of public infrastructure. And the final reason why you need to connect lifelong learning with meaningful work is that the vast majority of job relevant learning actually happens on the job. So to have a big training initiative or a big training fund disconnected from the work that needs to be done is not going to do what we need to do, right? What you want is, hey, these are infrastructure projects. And when there's more people who need to work, train them up to do that. It might take a while. It might not be shovel ready, but train them so that they're getting into a new thing. And I think we could create that kind of that sort of addendum to the labor market should ultimately be part of, whether we call it social insurance or whether we call it labor market design or something else, lifelong learning and meaningful work needs to be designed for in our systems.
Thank you. There's so much there. I actually have to say that the phrase lifelong learning is one that I've moved away from and banned. I tried to ban my team from using, not because it's not important, but just because it feels like we've been saying it for so long, that it's just become one of those things you say. If I'm in a tight corner on a panel as to what we should do about something, my go-tos have been lifelong learning and pre-K.
And the connection to earning is the thing that's always missing.
Yeah.
And I also observe that you can say it, that doesn't mean it happens. Like, we should start doing
right.
it.
Right, because we've been saying it for a really long time, and it has been, and it was a really good way to get out of difficult conversations, which I will have lifelong learning. Right. Sure. Meanwhile, we have done essentially nothing about it. So anyway, there's lots there in all three. But Marcus, I want to bring you back in, having spent the last couple of years looking at all these issues for us. What are your thoughts on what you've heard and more generally?
In general, it's funny. It's like Byron was sitting in my head over the last couple of weeks, because many of the comments I was going to make were precisely these issues. So as not to be redundant, I mean, I actually talked about this with a couple of people about this, and it's just interesting that he and I are on the same wavelength. I do agree that we need to have these sort of, you think about the social insurance of the future, we need to have these automatic sort of responses. So just to kind of piggyback off his statement, since they mirror mine so many. So one of the things that I was suggesting is that we need to rethink the way we've structured our social insurance system. It's been an emphasis. So classic public economics, fiscal federalism, right? But, you know, as the COVID-19 crisis has kind of shown us, is that fiscal federalism has led to a wide variety of social insurance responses that, you know, leave some people getting their checks almost immediately, like here where I am in Illinois. Whereas I know some people who live in places like Virginia and some other states who still haven't received any of their unemployment benefits. They've been off work nearly 8 months. And so this sort of thing, if we are going to ensure people are able to receive sufficient resources to engage in, continuing to learn rather than lifetime learning, you know, and be able to put themselves in the position to transition, especially if we anticipate that there might be increased volatility in the future. Like, I agree with all my colleagues on this panel that I don't think work is going away, right? It's just the nature of that work. And I worry about that there's going to be a set of occupations that are going to be highly skilled and that are going to be available to a certain subset of people because they either have the know-how, they have the resources, they have the ability to kind of jump into these highly skilled positions. And then there's a whole set of other jobs that are going to be open because people haven't received the requisite training. And so I agree with Byron again here is that we need to anticipate that, right? We need to have a pool of people, and many of whom who may have recently lost their jobs, and put them in position to actually gain the training they need. So A, they don't have to stay on social insurance per se for a very long time, right? And so that's where the automatic sort of nationalized nature of social insurance is going to be key, right? Let's get people what they need, get them training, and get them back out. I think of how we do with a lot of occupations like the State Department or the CIA or some of our other government agencies. When they need to redeploy a worker off to another country, they bring them back for 6 months to a year, give them intensive training, and put them back out in the field. Right. And so I think we can do that for more of our labor force. And that'll be great in terms of having a more dynamic labor market response to get people where they need to be to earn. Right. I mean, ultimately, I think so to go back to your original question about things like is a universal basic income the right program? I think one of the problems with these sorts of things is that they're not well targeted. Right. And so we need to think about targeted investments in people to get them back to the workforce. And I agree that by and large, most people really respond to actually having something to do. I think very few people really want to sit at home. And so equipping them with the skills to get back in to the workforce as soon as possible in this automated future will probably be the best thing for both sort of their well-being, but also our well-being and our dynamic economy here in this nation.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's drill in on a couple of these things. I have some questions coming in as well, and maybe come back to the rest of the panel. Feel free just to respond to anything else you've heard from your co-panelists. But I think actually a nice place to start is around this idea of adjustment assistance, right? So TAA without the T, because I think the evidence supports you, Byron, that it's almost impossible. I mean, trying to figure out exactly where in the chain this kind of went wrong is very difficult. So adjustment assistance or active labor market policy, whatever. But this idea that something kicks in, right? You need help, right? You've lost your job. There's an adjustment required here, but it's pretty expensive. You need not only the money, but the time or the opportunity cost, as you kind of put it, especially if you're later on in life, you may have, you've got kids to look after, you've got bills to pay. It's very different than when you're 17. So it can be, it's not necessarily a cheap option. I just kind of like to get reflections. Maybe Michael can start with you and then Deanna, just the thoughts on this idea of this kind of adjustment, this kind of bounce, this triggering that kind of Byron's identified, and then maybe kind of come back and see what you think more on that. Michael, does that fit with your idea of how a modern or future social insurance system should work? And if so, are we willing to invest as heavily as we might need to in it?
Yes, I think it does. I think the most important, or at least one of the most important observations, is that we should be agnostic about the cause of the job loss. There is a academic debate about whether or not automation or trade has reduced employment in certain areas more. That debate has enormous political consequences, of course. We've just gone through 4 years of a protectionist administration, and this argument that trade with China has really adversely affected the middle class. But at the end of the day, our program should be designed to advance economic opportunity to workers who need economic opportunity. And it shouldn't matter whether they lost their job due to trade or whether they lost their job due to technology or whether they lost their job due to some other factor. Our goal should be to provide on-ramps to the labor market success. And it shouldn't matter why you need to get on the ramp. So that I think is extremely important. We've given a lot of TAA, trade adjustment assistance, that gets folded into trade agreements for political reasons, and that's fine. And maybe we still need to do that for politics, but we should have an identical program for people who lose their jobs due to technology or other reasons as well. Is it going to be expensive? Some of it could be. Some of it doesn't have to be. I mean, what we saw in the aftermath of the Great Recession was significant differences in labor markets across states. Some states, North Dakota, for example, had an unemployment rate of 3 or 4% at the same time that states like California and New Jersey had unemployment rates of 8 or 9%. There were workers in California and New Jersey who were receiving unemployment benefits for months and months and months and months and months. Why not allow them to take some fraction of that unemployment benefit that they received week after week after week and use it to move to North Dakota, where they could get a job that would pay well? That would help those workers. It would also help the economy recover faster from the recession by bringing down the unemployment rate in places where it was too high. You know, I think that there are, of course, going to be other programs that will need more financing than that, where you can't just redirect existing financing. But I think we're getting better at understanding how to do those in a cost-effective right. manner. Work-based learning programs, for example, are both more effective when done right at imparting skills to mid-career workers. And Richard, they address your concern, which is totally reasonable, that mid-career workers often have financial obligations they have to meet. In a work-based learning model, you're still earning some income while yeah. also gaining skills and credentials.
Yeah, I think this earn and learn thing, which Annalise Goger at our shop has done quite a lot of work on, is hugely important part of it. Just in terms of the money, I did a back of the envelope calculation that for every dollar we spend on trade adjustment assistance right now, we spend about $25 in subsidies to the endowments of elite colleges. So it feels to me there's probably some money that we could reallocate. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be anti-Ivy League or anything or think that their endowments are too big and that they could maybe tax, but...
We also spend a lot of money on middle-class seniors.
Sure. Right. But let's... Even if you just kept it within the human capital bucket, like the amount of money we... Deanna, I just want to let Deanna in if that's okay. Anything on sure. this?
I guess I would underscore something that both Michael and Byron and Marcus, actually, all three have underscored, but that I think is really important. Part of the colossal failure of the TAA programs, in my view, was that they were very hard to access, to your point, Byron, about they need to be more automatic. But importantly, they were parallel and disconnected from any real activity that engages work. So any adjustment assistance that we should consider as being effective has to be integrally linked to work. And if that means you subsidize work that is guaranteed to give an employee skills, that I would be excited about. It combines work with the training, et cetera. So in general, I don't think we've given enough thought to the critical role of an employer or a workplace as the place where you get the training. And so I would think that would be an important design element. The other point I would raise is an idea that needs more details to be well executed, but I think is a really powerful concept, which is that it is too true, unfortunately, that many employers are hiring people with a set of skills that they deplete and then they send them back out into the workforce with the depleted skills relative to where they came in at their time in their journey in employment. And there should be, in my view, a reward or maybe a penalty for laying off a worker that is not more skilled than the worker that walked in the door. And I'm, you know, again, you could do it through some form of a credit. You could do it through credentialing and credits or otherwise. But I think we would all feel better in a world that is likely to have more turnover, that an employer has an obligation to take a set of skills, improve them, whether that person stays in that job or not, that they're more credentialed on the way out than they were when they arrived. And I don't know how much thought has been given to that. And I know some companies are thinking hard about how to make that part of the value proposition for talent at all levels. But I think that could be part of an interesting design program. Okay. I do want to come back to something you said, Richard, though, which is that in all of these conversations, of course, we all believe in pre-K. Of course, we all believe in skills training. Of course, we all believe in well program adjustments. But I still think that there is a higher level issue if we managed many of those things, that for a vast majority of Americans, even those who are still employed, we have an economy that just is not delivering the basics. And, you know, if you consider, I mean, the great work that Adam Loomy has just done with the middle class income increased three times what the market income did. So without the transfers and all the government stuff, we're just not creating pathways that allow people to have a house, to educate their children, to provide a little leisure and some form for retirement. And I worry that that we really do need a slightly more fundamental rethink about how do we provide meaningful work, as you suggest, Byron, which I think is critical to our livelihoods, but that that is not a condition for the basic ability to live a life. And I think I'm really concerned for our this economy's ability to deliver that to a very large swath of the population.
Well, just to help Richard avoid plugging his own book, I think the Dream Hoarders book that Richard published a little while ago is very relevant here, because like, why has higher education, to some extent healthcare, certainly housing, why is that so much more expensive relative to a classic middle class income? It's very much because those, it's like, let's take education and housing. So what is gentrification about? Gentrification is about you can't build because of NIMBYism, you can't build, you know, middle class, you know, upper middle class housing in the areas you'd want to build it. So you sort of push out the people with no political power. But the fact of the matter is, to get more affordable housing, sure, there's affordable housing policy, but there's more housing, right? And all this technology, and so we could build more houses less expensively, more modularly. We could actually employ more people in it, and they wouldn't have to earn less because there's a massive latent demand for actual housing. But you have to sort of break out of this political economy that favors, you know, the top kind of 10%. And I think a very similar thing actually happens on this nexus between education and employment. And I think it's astonishing that we take for granted that healthcare, like businesses, are part of like the healthcare social insurance system, which is a little arbitrary. But on the skills, like businesses and its activities taken for granted, we say, what do schools and government have to do? I mean, actually, if you look at the changes in the last 30, 40 years, it's really changes in business practices that have been massive, right? Like in terms of who they hire, right? Like on what basis? So when we talk about the cost, and Richard and Michael, you were talking about the cost of kind of, you know, like the adjustment assistance and so forth, the cost is much, much higher than it needs to be because of the way employers train. So if you are a project manager in construction and you don't have a bachelor's degree, say, you have like 85% of the skills to be a project manager in a hospital, say, but like you lose your job in construction because construction tanks, you know, sort of downturn. Do you know how hard it is to like be able to get recognized and have get a job, get that last 15% of training, even at the company for a job as a project manager in a hospital? It is ridiculous. Like, if you treated American, there's 71 million Americans who are deeply attached to the labor market, but do not have bachelor's degrees. They have all sorts of skills from working on the job, STARS. They're skilled through alternative routes. Right now, there are tens of millions of jobs that say STARS, these 71 million Americans, cannot apply. Not we evaluate your skills and find them wanting, but we will not consider your skills a priori. I believe if you did that to German steel, you'd have a WTO case against you. But we do it to 70 million American workers. And that massively raises the cost. So before, employers should be, as Deanna said, I think employers, like the incentives to do the right thing. But frankly, there are some very wrong things that are being done right now that need to stop. And it's really, it has a social destructive effect. It's almost like a pollution. It's like a very negative externality, the way these systems work. And we cannot ignore the employer role if we think about skills, training, and work as part of a social insurance system.
It isn't part of the problem there, but you have to move on. Part of the problem there, Byron, just maybe 1 minute on this, is whose interests is it, right? If employers should be incentivized to take people with the right skills and don't care if you happen to get a BA or otherwise, it's more efficient to do so. And the problem comes back to the fact that for those who are in a position to get those credentials or get them for their kids, why on earth wouldn't you want an economy built on credentials, right? So for those with credentials, a credentializing economy is awesome. And guess what? We can go get them, So what's the incentive? Like what's the political economy of this seems to me to be the kind of challenge here. Everything you've said just feels entirely right to me. And if it's true, then it should change, but it won't because the vested interest against it. Can you just say a minute on the politics of this, Byron?
Yeah. Well, I think we have some pretty extensive recent evidence that rigging the system of employment against 70 million working class Americans isn't great politics. It isn't great for our political economy. It isn't great for the values that a lot of these highly credentialed folks share. So I think writ large, it's actually an incredibly damaging thing. And it should be very high on the list of reforms to make the system work more fairly for everyone. Because I can tell you the phrase or variants of the phrase, "I know what I can do, but no one will give me a chance," is something I've heard from Americans in every part of the country, urban, rural, exurban, you name it, white, black, brown, everything. And that is actually, in a funny way, a sad way, a unifying experience of tens of millions of Americans. And I think it's very consistent with both our politics and our values. And it's actually not that hard to do to change the system so that if you can do the job, you can get the job. And if you can learn the skills, you can then earn more from them. And that's it. You could, if you look at that system end to end and you do that with intention, you actually can design a system that works that way. And the technology actually helps you, doesn't hurt you. But you got to care and you got to want to. And, you know, Richard, we live in a cynical age and you just made a very cynical statement. So I don't know, maybe in a heart of hearts, like all the people with power, like just want to keep the other tens of millions down, but it's not a sustainable strategy if they do. And frankly, we all actually lose from the standpoint of the innovation and the creativity and the resourcefulness that you see in essential workers as they reconfigure systems and all that. Those are exactly the kind of skill sets and dynamism and adaptability that employers say and mean that they need, but they're looking not in all.
I only made a cynical statement in order to provoke an inspiring statement from you, Byron. I just want to make it clear about that. Deanna, did you want to say one more thing really quickly, and then we need to move to... Look like you were leaning forward. I think good. All right. In that case, I'm going to move. That's a perfect segue, actually, to the next panel. I would love to carry on with this one, but we have great panelists who are coming up too. So just kind of let me thank you, Marcus. Thank you again for leading this work at Brookings. Please check it all out. Thank you to our distinguished guests. Thank you to Michael and Deanna and Byron. Just terrific stuff. Thank you for all your work in this space. And we'll now move on to the next panel. Thank you all for coming. So we're now going to move on. Actually, it was a perfect segue into this issue of opportunity and equity. Obviously, there's a fine line between thinking about insurance and thinking about opportunity, thinking about equity, and what it means to think about opportunity and upwards mobility. So if we think about the first session as partly about just insuring against risk, the second panel is also going to be looking at how do we make sure that there's equitable access to resources? How are we upwardly mobile, both intergenerationally from one generation to the next, but also intragenerationally? How can workers move up the ladder? And how do we ensure equitable access to the jobs, the resources, and the training, the assistance that we've just been talking about? I think it's true to say that we have a challenge in terms of equity and opportunity in the US, inter and intra-generationally, and that policy has been inadequate to meet that challenge thus far. And it's not going away. It's a slower moving. It's a sort of slow burn crisis, perhaps, rather than the quick burn that we've seen of 2020, but nonetheless. So this session is specifically on opportunity and equity, and thrilled to be joined by some new panelists who are kind of in the same format, going to kind of weigh in on this question. Again, I've kept up my blue sky to think forward. What are the equity challenges and opportunity challenges for the next couple of decades? We're going to create jobs, it sounds like, but who's going to get them? What's going to be the allocation of the good jobs, the quality jobs, etc.? What obstacles are there already, or might there be new to upward mobility, this sense of being able to kind of move up? What might we need to do differently or better to promote equity in the more automated world that we're already in and moving into more generally? So with that in mind, I'm just going to very briefly introduce our panel, and then I'll ask each of them to just say just a few words on those subjects, and then we'll get into it. So first of all, we're going to hear from Peter Blair, who is Assistant Professor of Education at Harvard, and a good friend of Brookings. So thank you, Peter, for joining us. I'm looking forward to your comments. Kara Swisher, who is a columnist with the New York Times and also a host of a really, really excellent podcast called Sway, which if you don't listen to it, then I really, really think you should. It's excellent. And then my colleague, Nicole Turner-Lee, who's a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and is the director of our Center on Technology Innovation, has done a lot of work thinking about the intersection of technological change and equity. So thrilled to have all of you, and we'll just do the same thing again. So Peter, if you want to kick us off, then I come to Cara and Nicole. Peter.
Yeah, sure. And let me just share my screen for a moment here.
Sure.
It's a pleasure to be here with you all, Richard, on this really important topic. And I found the first panel incredibly insightful. And what I want to do here is just to frame this issue within a generational view in terms of how the US labor market has been changing over time. So in this first picture here, what I want to do is just really highlight the fact that there are over 71 million Americans who are active in the labor force who have high school diplomas, but who don't have college degrees. And I want to really focus in on this group of workers for the following reason. If we look at the future of work in the United States, about 74% of jobs that are going to be created in the future are going to be created in companies where they typically would hire workers with college degrees. And so that necessarily is going to be screening out close to three quarters of Black workers, Hispanic workers, and workers in rural America. And so these are huge swaths of the United States that are already in a lot of ways very vulnerable, especially in this current COVID context. Secondly, if we look over the broad swath of time, what we can see is that in the past 50 years, we've seen increasing mobility for workers with bachelor's degrees, and we've seen declining fortunes in terms of real wages for workers with high school degrees or less. And so this population is already pretty hard hit. And so the question is, you know, what is it that we can do? And so something that I've been working on with colleagues at Opportunity at Work, as well as Erica Goshen, who is at Cornell University, is really thinking about how can we address this population of US workers who represent a large fraction of the US labor force, but who've been experiencing downward mobility for the past 5 years. Now, there are a couple of things that we could do. You could say, well, why don't we just give everybody a college degree? Well, we would effectively have to double the amount of slots for higher education in the United States. And given the rising cost of college in the US, that's not something that's tenable. And so what we want to offer is something that's going to be a lot more immediate, something that's going to engage both employers and employees. And the core idea is the following. If we can look at workers who have high school degrees, but not college degrees, and recognize that they're learning skills as they do the jobs that they're currently in, then we can see them as stars, people who are skilled through alternative routes. So for example, somebody might start out in a job as a retail salesperson, and a lot of those skills are going to be transferable to a job as a customer service representative, which is a higher wage job. And you can think about the labor market as, where do I enter? How do I transition to a gateway job? And that gateway job can then take me to another job that's going to increase my wages. And so at each point along this juncture, workers are learning as they're earning, and their learnings is being translated into future earnings too. And I just have here highlighted a star, Alishana Lewis here too, who went from being a customer service representative to being a software engineer. So this is not something that's pie in the sky. I wanna end with the following figure. So one of the things that we did in our recent NBR working paper is to look at like what's the likelihood of mobility for workers who have a college degree versus workers who don't. And then we separately bin that into job transitions where wages decrease for the worker, or wages are stagnant, or wages increase. And we look at the gaps in terms of those mobility. And so over the past like 40 years, for each year, the mobility for workers who have college degrees versus stars in stagnant transitions or in transitions that lead to downwardly mobile wages, it's basically a coin flip whether college workers are better off versus workers without college degrees or stars. But when we look at the upwardly mobile jobs, this is the place where every year, for the past like 40 years in the United States, college workers have benefited from greater mobility than workers without workers who are stars. And so really like the fundamental takeaway from this work is that if we think about looking at workers based on their skills, we recognize that there's a large swath of folks who have the skills to earn higher wages, but it really comes down to recognizing that when it comes to upward mobility, that firms need to take the skills of stars very seriously, not just when it comes to stagnant wage transitions. And so that's a key part of the research agenda that we've been focusing on, is like, how can we engage workforce partners to help to upskill workers and to help to create pathways for mobility for workers who are stars in the labor market?
Great. Thank you, Peter. That was a perfect introduction. And thank you for, I thought we were going to have an economic studies event without any charts for a horrible moment there, but you've saved us. We have charts and excellent charts there too. So Karen, I'm going to come to you next. You obviously, a lot of your work is in the tech space, thinking about the role of technology in the industry more generally, but also in terms of kind of equity. I was struck by your recent interview with Raj Chetty, where you asked him about the equity fate or equality fate age, and he said 23, mm-hmm. which I think does speak to this point that Peter's just made, which is this idea that industry generally, the labor market generally, just judges what you do in the first quarter century of your life, and yep. after that, so it's more like high jump than hurdles, if you like, right? It's like you enter the right credentials, probably going to be okay. Don't, you're probably not, and a little chance of movement in between. First of all, is that a fair characterization of the?
Yeah, the world? For some people, it's third grade, actually. You know, in terms of their ability to move out, and it also has to do with zip code, which is something that Raj has been doing a lot, is taking actual data and inputting it rather than guessing, which a lot of our legislators have been doing. You know, these anecdotal guessing games around things when there's actually data about a lot of things, and I think that's one of the things is how we use the data for good. I mean, the data has obviously been pilloried for all the invasiveness. I write about this a lot. That, you know, I just wrote about my experience with Amazon's Halo, which was terrifying. But in terms of the data it inputs, but a lot of the data does show this issue around where you drop out, where the inability to move upwardly is very clear without some level of luck or particular drive, right? This is we're talking about, you know, everyone, it assumes that everyone's extraordinary and everyone isn't extraordinary. They are, you know, there's incredible talent everywhere, and the ability to access that talent has really been declining. And I think about it as, I call it talentism, that we have to really start to focus on talentism and credentialing in a very different way. And so you see a lot of tech companies trying to address this issue and what a credential is. Do you need a BA or whether others? Google has just announced their programs around credentialing. And qualifications based on a series of schooling that you take that isn't traditional schooling, that isn't college, that gets you into all kinds of debt. And you wonder whether it's worthwhile. The actual things that companies then you can take to a job, and this is just as good as a BA. And what you've got to do is get companies, maybe starting with tech companies, to accept, which have been notoriously, you know, the big joke at Google is you had to go to Stanford or MIT, or you didn't get to go, and maybe MIT, you wouldn't get into these things. And so the idea of what is a credential and what is a qualification and what is a training. And I think it's been sort of off to the side and been done by companies in a haphazard, and often tech companies to do this. And so I think a lot of that is really promising, especially the Google programs to give certification and credentialing. And so employers can feel that they are getting the kind of skills they need. You talked earlier about this idea of lifelong learning, and I know one of you said it was like, oh, I just throw that in. But really, I mean, right now, the job market is about that, because what we've got to start to get used to is this idea of not just lifelong learning, is that if you don't continue to upgrade your skills, you're going to be held back rather significantly. And then secondly, that you don't have these opportunities to do that, but you become useless as an employee over time. And I think that's the other side we don't pay attention to, is the lack of ability to move upwards and to continue to train. I think most workers are now going to have 10 jobs, or there's some number, I forget the last one I saw, but especially young workers. And then the last part I think we should discuss is this idea of what a gig worker is and what it means. Every single person is going to be a gig worker. I mean, I just did an interview with the Cameo, which people make fun of because it's like Seb Gorka wishing you a happy birthday, or, you know, it's celebrities doing all kinds of things, but it's about gig work. These people get one person who was on The Office is now getting paid $1 million to give greetings. And I know it sounds dumb, but you could see this start to Patreon, OnlyFans, all kinds of things where you sort of collapse the ability to earn and find everyone becomes a worker in a different way, removing the gatekeepers and the ways that you got into jobs. And so we have to think about what that means for healthcare, all kinds of benefits, and the ability of companies to hire. And then the very last thing is obviously impact the pandemic around where work is. And I think that's going to be a massive issue, because I don't think we're going back. I interviewed the head of Tata, thinking of having you on the podcast. I called him up. I think he employs hundreds of thousands. I forget the number he employed, but he said that 15% of his workers were remote at the start of the pandemic. Now it's 85%. You know, they're a conglomerate. They employed, it's one of the biggest employers in India. And he doesn't want to go back. And so many employers really do understand the financial efficiencies of not having people in a workplace. And so what does that mean for different levels of workers, and especially workers who have to physically be present in places? One of the things that really struck me is Nicole Hannah-Jones. I did an interview with her, and she, instead of calling them essential workers, we have to start calling them sacrificial workers at this point for the economy. And they're largely, a lot of them are people of color, they're people who are poor, they're people that have to be present. They have higher incidences of the virus, of catching the virus. And so we are designing a system, a pandemic, really, for rich people. I mean, it really is, in terms of testing, in terms of, you know, benefits that pharmaceutical companies get. Those tests you take that cost $200 really actually cost them $6. There are tests that cost $20, cost 50 cents. There's something going on here that's really problematic and designed for people who can stay home. But that's going to be the trend. So that's a big issue, is technology is more and more allowing us to stay, certain workers to stay home and others not. And so what do we do about that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the previous panel, there was an agreement that, you know, we haven't had this massive change as a result of automation. But ironically, the change that we all thought was happening and now we didn't think and might now be.
Automation is going to kill a lot of jobs.
Right. Well, that was part of the conversation.
That never went away. Are you kidding me? That's what Amazon just talked about, this Monitron. I don't know if you've seen this new thing they're coming out with, which is it monitors factory workers and machines.
Oh. There's nothing good about the word Monitron.
Well, exactly. I know. I was thinking, what room were they coming up with? But they're not white. They're without white labeling it to everybody.
That is terrible branding, if nothing else. Okay. We're going to move on. There's a lot in all of this so far from both of you. But Nicole, I want to bring you in, and then I'll kick things back.
So thank you, Richard, for having me. And it was so good to see Marcus on the first panel. I actually listened to that first panel. And let me just caveat my remarks by saying I'm a sociologist. So I'm all about structure. So all these economists and educational specialists on this panel, I'm just going to tell you I'm coming out a little different in terms of what I actually propose. I mean, I want to actually just deal with the people of color, particularly African-Americans, that are going to be affected by automation. When Richard asked me to join, you know, whenever I think of equity and opportunity, I go back to what is most familiar to me, and that is the fate of the Black worker. And in particular, we already know that automation was coming. I mean, this is not new in terms of the shifts that affected African-American workers. We saw it with the manufacturing revolution. We saw it with the early stages of technology. Today, it's a little different because of what Kara said. The pandemic has accelerated the fact that now people who were essentially frontline workers or sacrificial workers, right, are now in a space where they're not getting the skills that they need to actually survive outside of this. I mean, there are 100,000 small businesses that are going to be closed as a result of this pandemic because they were not agile enough to adapt to new technology. Those folks that were employed by those businesses, particularly Black businesses, will not be coming back to a job. And so now we have this place where we actually are going to have this mismatch between supply and demand, which I think are really important for Black workers. One, I think I'm preaching to the choir when I say that, you know, we already know that African-American workers without a college degree will be disproportionately impacted. Black men in particular, Black women next. We also know, as the other panelists have suggested, that there's this multiplier effect that comes with this accelerated loss of revenue among businesses, wage disparities, the fact that we have educational achievement losses. Let me leave you with one statistic on what I've been working on as well, which is broadband access and school-age children. McKinsey just recently came out and said that Black children, Black K through 12 students who are disconnected from school, whether virtually or in person, will be behind 10.3 months in learning. Those learning losses are going to show up for low-income kids by a year and Latina kids by about 8 months. What that means, I've been telling people, that in the next decade when those kids go out to work, they're not going to be able to have the skills necessary to compete in the new economy, which is interesting to me because technically they're doing all of this. So they may actually have some of the skills necessary to work in disaggregated work environments or to be decentralized, right, in their work functions. I have a 14-year-old daughter who says to me every day, if I have to work like this, I don't want to work. But she doesn't realize that is the future of industry. When you begin to pile on these other systemic inequalities, you have to wonder, what do we do next? And I am really taken by the earlier conversation as well as what my fellow panelists have said. The attention towards people of color is going to be most important, because oftentimes they are not in jobs that actually have those type of training benefits that allow them to upskill. And so as a result of the rapid acceleration of digitization in our society and world, they're going to be left behind. And that's really dangerous for us because that means that the only roles that Black and Hispanic workers can take are in roles that have these other very, you know, consequential activities related to this public health pandemic. Right. Depending on the age, they may not be vaccinated. Depending on where they work, they may not be upskilled towards technological skills. With that being the case, I would also add to this, and I'll just close out with just a couple things to think about for this conversation. They also don't have broadband access. So as we move systems of training from inline to online, you now have workers who are disserviced because they can't get online to connect. So I'm doing a, Richard actually helped me with this. So Richard, I changed the title of my book. So it's Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass, comes out next year, Brookings Press. What I found after doing a qualitative interviews across the country is that many of the workers that we're referring to who have been impacted by automation don't even have the minutes to take them through the entire month to connect to a new job or to connect to workforce training. So that in of itself is another problem. So what do we do? I mean, I'll just throw this out for conversation again. I'm the outlier when it comes to broadband access. First and foremost, we have to accelerate broadband access. With automation comes the assumption that people will have access to technological tools. We cannot be in a space, and I was just on a panel prior to this, where we're using inline, in-person, old archaic service delivery models to get people to a place where they can be competitive and receive livable wage scale jobs. It doesn't work anymore. Everything is online and we have to figure out ways to accelerate broadband access for that purpose. I would say the second thing we need to do, and this is something I've been proposing in my book as well as my work, is we need a tech new deal. Decades out, we should be thinking about the relationship between broadband infrastructure, workforce development, and the various industries that we are going to see come out of this new economy. Why is that important? When you have a tech new deal, you begin to look at the Department of Labor apprenticeship programs as ways to sort of jump shot how people get into the new economy. I'll give you a perfect example. A couple years ago, or 5 years ago now, when I was at a previous job, the Department of Labor had the apprenticeship program. There were no monies allocated to things like wireless infrastructure training, despite the full gamut and robustness of wireless ecosystems and the emergence of 5G. Three groups got together, civil rights organization, an industry organization, as well as another association, to sort of come up with a plan to train Black men and women on how to get into these industries, which are livable wage scale jobs. What that taught me is that we tend to focus on coding and other computer science engineering jobs when really we have an infrastructure much like the dams and the roads and the highways of the past that need to be built. To me, that's an important pivot in automation. And then I would say the third thing is we need to train across and not out. So there's this assumption that only Black workers have to be trained in ways where they have these credentials to actually compete in this space. I love what Peter said. In some cases, the skilling is the most important thing, and maybe the credentialing might be more important than actually trying to figure out what kind of degree you have. When you train across, you have the potential to actually bring in people who have to just change their way of thinking about work that is very different than what they're used to. So I'll give you a perfect example, then I'll shut up. So when I go back to the example of the car industry, you can train people out of new models of automation and innovation in a variety of sectors. But when you train them out, you also lose the type of expertise and talent knowledge retention that will also be able to provide support. Because at the end of the day, the car still needs a shell. It still needs an engine. And it still needs people to understand the supply chain. I wrote something for Robin Kelly a couple of years ago when she was interested in this whole thing about the future of work. And what they could not reconcile in Congress is, well, where do we put those resources so that we can allow people to train across rather than to train out? For Black workers, that is so particularly important because what it suggests is that we're not putting resources in places to invest in the workers where they're at. And I think somebody said that earlier, meeting people where they're at and allowing them to grow with the industry, not grow on the margins of the industry. And that to me is the most important part of this, Richard, and hopefully in this conversation. Yeah. Automation is not passive. There is an ideation process and a production process that unfortunately on the equity side, millions of Americans who do not fit the profile of big tech are actually excluded from participating. And it's seen, we're seen almost as a group of people that need to stay in one vector versus being able to adjust our behaviors, our leadership skills, our work skills to be able to participate.
Okay, so thank you.
There's
a lot here we could dig in. So thank you all of you for your comments. Let's dig in a bit because there's so many. I think there's distinctions here between we want to lower the stakes of what happens early in life. We want to change the skill distribution, its current inequality. We also want to reveal the existing skill distribution as it is, rather than camouflaging it with credentials. So that's what I'm trying to sort of break down some of these kind of different challenges a little bit and come back to this kind of issue. I want to be clear, Cara, when I sort of said, like, I'm sick of saying lifelong learning, it wasn't because I don't think it's hugely important. It's because I think it's just become a glib thing for policy people to say without ever actually doing it. Or you think about what we actually require. So Cara, can you say a bit more about the difference between talentism and credentialism? And then maybe I'll come back to you, Peter, as well, to say, how do we kind of uncamouflage the skill distribution even as it is, even before we start, before we kind of start changing that skill distribution? But Cara, back to you first, because I wanted to ask this before, but didn't want to delay the movement. Talentism.
They're not unlike each other. They're different things, obviously. Talentism is a concept that I keep talking about, which is that there's talent everywhere. It needs to be accessed. It's like precious minerals in the ground that never get out, like the little girl in Syria who has the answer to cancer, or whoever is. Where do you find and how do you access talent? And I think that technology could facilitate that if it's used properly, because you begin to train people in places that they weren't, that they're not able to get out of, wherever it is, or give them access to things. And I think the issue is we've decided that certain people deserve access and certain people don't. The fact that we don't have a widespread broadband is it's like saying we didn't have universal telephone service. It's literally like, here's two tin cans and a string, good luck, people. And then wonder why they're not as good. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this, we design the answers to be the answers we want to have, which is not to give people the fact we're a third world country in broadband access. The other countries don't take this as a serious national security issue too, because it's really important, even though there's issues around hacking and everything else, the inability, and this pandemic has shown it perfectly. The inability of everyone to get good access for education for these kids, we are setting people back. Like, you can't even believe, like, the impact of this is going to be so vast, especially in people that were already had problematic school experiences, like that, and problematic, I'm being nice, shitty school experiences. And so, and by the way, even if you have money and means, it's still a terrible experience, right? And so they're getting set back emotionally from an educational point of view. And so that's one issue. That's one issue of where talent is and how we access it and give it the kind of support that it needs to get. And we find the people, because we're just wasting our time. Like, when you look at, just Tesla just came out with numbers. I guess it was Tesla or SpaceX. That's 87% white men at the top of the management. Is that the white men just smarter than the rest of us? I don't know. It seems like if you looked at the hiring practices, they must be, because they seem to get all the jobs. Wow, that's amazing. Good for them. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous waste of talent. The second part around credentialism is that we have to be able to get people to get credentials that matter if they can't go through the various gates we set up for people. And so how do we get them credentials that count to put them onto the chain that gets you from one place to the next? Get them on the, I don't want to use ladder, but you know what I mean? It's the same thing. How do you get them credentialed so that it counts as much as a kid who is probably wouldn't make it anywhere else gets into Harvard because his dad gets him in or whatever. I guess some schools don't let that happen anymore, but it happens. It happens in other ways. And so how do you make credentials, and how do companies value credentials on the same way? Because right now we're designing an economy that has, how many people are in the United States right now? What's the population?
300 million.
Right. Okay. We have like 10 million lords and 290 million serfs. That's what we're doing. That's the economy we're creating. And it's really, it's a problem. And what used to be, you had what you have is the very top, you have obscenely wealthy people at the top. And I'm sorry to say this, but $160 billion one person should not have on this planet. I'm sorry. It's just like, even if he's smart, it's just beyond belief. So they have all this money, this small, very small group of people. And then you have this middle class and you have class in between. And then you have the middle class. And then the people who have been screwed and screwed and screwed over. They're mired in opiates, in lack of education, and now conspiracy theories and everything else. And it's just it's lack of information, lack of anything. And it used to be the middle class right in the middle that would pull those people up, and they would be pulled up, the middle class, by the people above them. That's not happening. Everyone's getting stuck in these things. And so the idea of credentialing and giving people acknowledgement of their skills and training of their skills and putting them on useful paths to be able to move up is really critical, or we're going to create this. Let me finish by saying, I always say to Silicon Valley people who complain, like, we made it on our own. And, that, you know, of course, not understanding they started on not just third base. They were like 5 feet from home and they managed to hit a home run. I always say to them, you're either going to have to invest in this and the people and getting them talent and giving them reasons to want to move upward, or just invest in armor plating your Teslas, because that's what you're going to end up doing. You're going to end up with a society where you are going to have to put yourself in small little areas of protection against the vast majority of people. And this rage is not, should not be a surprise.
Or they're going to, or they're buying up parts of New Zealand so that they can run to New Zealand.
I don't think New Zealand wants them.
No, well, apparently if you put enough money in.
She doesn't play. That woman, Jacinda Ardern, doesn't
play. I'm struck by some of the work that Joseph Fishkin's done on bottlenecks in the opportunity structure. So you've talked about economic inequality, but there are these inequities in the opportunity structure as well. And this idea of a bottleneck is that it's this narrow space that you have to pass through in order to get the good things on the other side, and the kind of the gatekeeping around those bottlenecks. And the U.S. has significant bottlenecks in its education system, but the consequences of not getting through that space are greater. The stakes are higher in the US labor market. And then you get this equity disaster we're seeing now with COVID, which we'll see kind of playing out over the next 10 to kind of 15 years. And so I think part of your work, Peter, is about, to some extent, trying to lower the stakes in the labor market by allowing skills to be more revealed and cultivated so that it's not game over at 23 or 24 or whatever it is. Can you say a bit more about how? We got into that a bit with Byron, but kind of, because it's, again, it's easy. Okay, I get it. But how? What does it mean in terms of like switching our financing of education and the labor market more generally?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you bring this up, Richard. And I have your book on my reading list to Opportunity Hoarders. And I just want to share a little bit about my own personal story. So I grew up in the Bahamas, came from a really large family. I have six older brothers, sold fruits and vegetables as a kid. And I went to community college before I came to the US. And from community college, went to Duke and then Harvard and then Wharton. And then I taught at a great public institution, Clemson University, and now I'm back on the faculty at Harvard. And so like a lot of my research has really been driven by seeing the ways in which people engaged with me very differently when I was Peter Blair, the student at the community college, versus Peter Blair, the student at Harvard or Duke or Wharton or the faculty member at Harvard, right? And in a lot of ways, what struck me about this was I was the same person, but there was something about the credential that changed the way that they looked at me, changed the opportunities that they gave me access to. And I always wrestled with this question as both a consummate insider and a consummate outsider, thinking about how many others are there who are not here in this moment? And more so, how many of my colleagues have not, or not so much colleagues, but students and others, have not interacted with somebody who does not come from the same like socioeconomic or educational stratum as them? And how does that color the way in which they think about the skills of those folks too, right? And so this is like a very foundational kind of conceptual problem that we have to really fix. And that's one of the reasons why I was really excited to partner with Opportunity at Work to say, look, we need to really change the way we think about who is skilled in the labor market. Most of us learn by doing. Somebody who comes out of the best law school in the United States, when they show up day one on the firm, they do not know how to write a brief. And they have to be taught how to write a brief. When I showed up as a faculty member, I had to learn how to teach. I had to learn how to be a mentor. And so my PhD really gave me the opportunity to learn more. And so one of the motivations behind our work is saying, how can we allow other people who don't have college degrees, but who are stars, they're skilled through alternative routes, how can we allow them to get their foot in the door where employers in turn say, let's give you an opportunity to like learn and earn. And then let's also valorize those skills so that that could translate into future opportunities for you to move through the labor market. And so this is a really deep conceptual point about how we see people, both in terms of what skills they actually have now, and also in terms of like what skills they could potentially have in the future. And I want to end by saying the following point. firms are both the recipients of talent and they're also the creators of talent. And we need to create a more interconnected ecosystem whereby companies are thinking about how can I develop the talent that's within my current firm in anticipation of the future needs that my company is going to have. I think that it's such low-hanging fruit to develop that skill in-house. And then secondly, to recognize that I'm going to be the beneficiary of somebody else training a worker who's coming to me. And so I need to pay it forward in terms of making sure that workers who leave my firm, either voluntarily or involuntarily, that they're leaving better than they came in. And so this really requires, and Nicole, I like the point that you raised about having a different set of social relationships. We need to really think in a really fundamental way about how we alter the social contract. Because one of the things that really has me very passionate about this work is that oftentimes various actors in the ecosystem are just thinking about how do I see students as tuition revenue, or how do I see workers as somebody who's going to move this widget from here to here tomorrow, not recognizing that when they are using someone, if they're not replenishing in a sustainable way the skills and the talents that somebody has, that the entire ecosystem is going to collapse unless we cooperate. And so I really want to say that we have a surefire way to get in through companies to think about ways that they can reskill their existing talent and to make sure that they're being contributors in this kind of like broader labor market ecosystem.
Okay, so I want to actually throw the same question back to all three of you, I think, because in different ways you've pushed at this. And I could ask it in kind of a challenging way to some extent, which is if it's clearly in employers' interests to develop talent within their companies and look at people. I mean, I should say this idea of looking at people is very important. For me, and I look out for this stuff when President-elect Biden said we need to see each other again. There's this interesting about who do you see? And Nicole, the fact that your book is about visibility, but seeing someone goes beyond just the idea of seeing them. It's like seeing them. So let me just play the cynical employer for a moment, right? If it's obviously in my interests to develop my people, then I would be doing it, right? You are not well-placed from Harvard to tell me how to run my business. Or Cara, if it was really my business interest to not have 75% of my senior people being white men and more diversity, I'd be doing it, right? And kind of Nicole, if it was really in my interest to be taking equity more seriously and expanding broad, I'd be doing it. And so I'm the employer that's sitting here running a business, listening to a bunch of people who don't run businesses, telling me what's in my economic interest and kind of saying to me, well, you're being a bit stupid, aren't you? You should do these things. So diversity, development, equity, they're all in your business interests. But if that's true, wouldn't I be doing it?
No, they don't. The statistics show very clearly that diverse workforces are better businesses. I mean, by the way, I run a business, so let me just say I actually.
So why don't they just do it then? If it's in their interest, what's
everything? Because they have this ridiculous narrative they tell themselves about a meritocracy when it's a mirrortocracy. They just see who they see, and they think those people are better, and they don't design systems that bring out the talent in everybody. We don't know what they're leaving on the table. We don't know just because they managed to make money in this one place that they're doing the very best they can. And I think most statistics, I mean, it's just like people don't always follow on actual data. They actually just follow on what they think they know. And that's anecdotal. And so they see, you know, I had one person say to me, you know, if there was a Marsha Zuckerberg, maybe we'd take women CEOs seriously. And I literally didn't know what to say to them. I just like women aren't on the cap tables of tech companies. They aren't on the top management. Cap tables are critically important, which is who makes money in these things. Okay. And if they don't get there, there's a whole bunch of people being floated around Silicon Valley, largely white men who are not talented, who manage somehow to do okay because they get floated upwards on the stream. And so, sure, you know, it's pretty easy to be talented when you're there. It's just they just don't. It's just a lie. It's just
well, there's an old saying: God give me the confidence of the mediocre white man. Like, I can hear you saying it's like God give me the wealth of the lucky one.
If I could jump in, I don't want to be a white male and I don't want the wealth of a white male with the wealth of a black woman who's successful as a white male. So I think part of the challenge is that we keep going into these conversations knowing that structural racism and discrimination already exists. It's, I think the challenge that we have whenever we have our conversations about opportunity and equity is that we don't start there. And if we start with the fact that this is already a structurally flawed system, then it actually allows us to move the blame from, in all honesty, a lot of big tech founders who didn't even finish college in terms of imposing a double standard on other workers who may have the same type of creativity and genuine exploration of their mind to actually create the next silicone, Sally creation in the alley of their community in the Bronx. I mean, part of the challenge when I think about these issues is we've got to develop, and I think Peter sort of mentioned that these ecologies, these ecosystems that allow people to thrive where they are. So for example, that's why I talk about Black businesses. Black businesses tend to be higher in terms of their employment of other Black people. If that's the case, then we need to fund startups and tech communities who want to create the alternative to Instacart. Startup founders get 60% less in terms of venture capital than other founders. Black women get more, Black men get less. And these are, according, you know, Richard, you studied this a lot. These are in line with persistent inequalities that affect people. But the challenge is if we stay in this mindset, we're only going to have governmental policies that tend to still be pathological, still rely upon the goodwill of white men and white workers, white leaders to make those kind of decisions and ignore the fact that people come with their values, assumptions, and norms about the world. What I think is actually the case is I think you have to invest in local community infrastructures, and you have to allow workers, particularly at a time where automation is rapidly changing the rate and speed at which we create things, allow people to also be part of this economy in a much more aggressive and proactive way. We make the assumption, and I have a 18-year-old that started his first year of college. We make the assumption that every Black boy should be forced into coding. And I didn't have a coder. I had a writer. And for all intents and purposes, that wasn't his route. He wants to be a journalist. But when we went through that process of what kind of scholarships, who would be interested, we found ourselves back into the same box that is often talked about when it comes to the opportunity metrics. And in my opinion, I think, and Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you're suggesting is we just need to break out and actually have some breakthrough ideas on how we think about bringing people who are marginalized into this new realm of automation. Not every person out there has to be a genius, as it has been demonstrated. Just read Malcolm Gladwell's book. What we need are the ecosystems that allow for that genius to happen wherever a person may be in their lifespan.
Right. Yeah. And you shouldn't have
credentialing is important.
And you shouldn't have to be extraordinary to come back to work. So, Peter, I'm going to bring you in. Peter's putting a bunch of econ talk in the chat, which no one, people who are watching this probably, you can't see, thank God. So, Peter, if you could put all this stuff about prisoners' dilemmas and coordination failures into English for our audience in terms of this specific issue around employer incentives, that would be great. And then I'm just going to give each of you like a final sentence and we'll have to wrap, unfortunately. Peter, go.
Yeah, sure. And I just want to touch on what Nicole mentioned about structural racism. So I think, and really inject a hopeful note, I think one of the silver linings of what has happened with this COVID moment and George Floyd's very tragic and unfortunate murder is it's really opened the eyes of so many people to some truths about America that Black people in America have known for a very long time, and it's no longer ignorable, right? And so we have this moment where people are realizing, oh my God, this is really terrible, and this is structural. And so how do we then use this moment to really do the kind of structural work that needs to be done? One of the things that I did with one of my colleagues at Opportunity at Work, Shahid Ahmed, was we wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, really addressing corporate America and saying to the CEOs who were at the time saying, here's $100 million, you know, to help with structural racism, to say, there's something that you can fundamentally do, which is change the way that you hire. Right? Because when we look at the legacy of education in the United States, it's been a legacy of exclusion of African Americans from the process. And so when you layer on top of that degree requirements for jobs that don't need degree requirements, it becomes a form of structural racism. And so that was our appeal to them. And we know that a lot of employers are now starting to rethink their degree requirements. In fact, the federal government recently issued an executive order saying that the federal government, the largest employer in the United States, would hire based on skills and not degrees. And so I think that we are really making progress in terms of reshaping the way that people are thinking, right? And so I'm very hopeful from that standpoint. To touch on kind of like, why is it that we don't see more firms really having this more ecological view, this more sustainable view of like where they fit into this ecosystem or like the circle of labor, I would call it, is oftentimes it's about what are peers doing. And we see that a lot with universities as well too. So in some sense, there's this coordination failure where if I do it And I'm starting to think a lot about diversity and inclusion and excellence, not just diversity and inclusion from a representational standpoint, but really I'm hiring people of color because they are the best, right? And I'm seeing the skills and talents that they bring to the table. But if I do it and nobody else does it, then when folks see a workforce that's diverse, they're going to think, well, am I getting an inferior product because none of the other people are doing this? And I think that's the problem. It's a coordination failure. And so what we really need is for either a leader to emerge who's going to say, I'm going to do this with my company, even if it means that others don't follow, and to really go long on that strategy, or a team of business leaders to say, this is going to become an industry standard across Google, Facebook, Tesla, so on and so forth. And this priority for us. And I think when you have that happening and it becomes normed, then all of a sudden it's no longer I'm the one company that looks like the odd woman out or the odd man out. So I think that's the fundamental issue. People look to their peer for cover, for doing the right thing.
I'd love your piece in the journal, by the way. And this I think this sharp point about credentialism is a form of structural racism, and really kind of bringing out that connection is good. So I'm going to take that as your last word, Peter. Unfortunately, we're a bit over time, so I'm going to get in trouble if we don't shut now. But it's just 30 seconds, and Nicole and Cara, if you have any final thoughts, Nicole.
Yeah, I would just say what Peter is talking about. I think it's disentangling this whole idea of corporate responsibility from the business effects of diversity, and really making sure we're having a clear conversation of that. And then I would just say the last thing is making sure people have what they need to participate in this economy. Broadband, internet-enabled devices, training, and those social networks that allow them to be better integrated into this full scope of the society.
I love this idea of a tech new deal with the infrastructure, mm-hmm. so you could then participation. Great. Cara, any thoughts you want to send us away?
I think we have to think about it. We have to rely on businesses to do this, because when it's imposed from the government, it really does have a problem on a lot of, one of the things we have to do is not thinking about it as a tech, but we have to understand ways to teach our citizens to be entrepreneurial. We were entrepreneurial for a long time, and it's sort of gotten lost. And so the idea of entrepreneurism is critically important. The second thing is, when you talk to these companies, and these are where a lot of the changes come, if you look at a lot of changes, social changes in our society, they were all wrought by corporations, IBM, Apple, all around gays, around people of color, all kinds of things did start at that level. And I think it really does have much more of a resonance if corporations take a lead here. You need the social justice and everything else to push up on it, but it's really critical that they do it, because what they do now is when they have diversity, they stack rank these things. If you think of stack ranking, if you want to understand tech, people think stack ranking. And so they have a list of 14 things, and diversity is always 7. It's never 1, and it's never done by the CEO. It's always sort of in the group. And so they say the words, and then it just doesn't happen, and it doesn't filter down. And so you have to get them to stack rank it right at the top, and it has to come from these. Unfortunately, nothing tech people like more than a society where there's a god on the top. So let their particular tech gods decide it and push it down. And that's where the pressure has to come from. It doesn't come from below. It just doesn't. And so that's really important, is to change their stacks.
Well, I love the way we've ended this conversation with this, with a call. This is not just a public policy, but more broadly, I think particularly those who work in public policy, you tend to think, oh, government, oh, Congress, oh, administration, whatever. And of course, that's hugely important. But actually, policies made in boardrooms and policies made by employers and their norms, the norms and practices and assumptions and prejudices.
Well, let me just say, Jeff Bezos just hired 500,000 people during the pandemic.
Right.
Let's start with him.
Like, yeah, that's a pretty big, if Joe Biden had a public works program that created that many jobs, they'd definitely get on the front page, right? And so I think this kind of idea about employer policy and corporate policy and how it interacts with public policy is just a great place to finish. We must finish. Thank you all so much. Check out everyone's work. Nicole, can't wait for your book. Peter, congrats on all your work and journal. Cara's podcast and writing is unmissable in this space. So thank you all for joining us.